bringing it straight down. Symbol trashing. A lot the peasants and factory workers would care about their piece of high-tech baublery getting junked. And decapitation. Probably the most worrying idea of the lot for the high priests. What if the Empire thought of doing it to them? He assured them that the Empire would be in no state to retaliate, and when they offered peace, the priests would hint heavily they had used a missile of their own, not the spacecraft, and pretend there were more where that came from. Even though this would not be difficult to disprove, especially if one of the world's more sophisticated societies chose to tell the Empire what had really happened, it would still be worrying for whoever was trying to work out what to do on the other side. Besides, they could always just get out of the city. Meanwhile, he went to visit more army units. The Imperial Army started its advance again, though slower than before. He had drawn his troops back almost to the foothills of the mountains, burning the few unharvested fields and razing the towns behind them. Whenever they abandoned an airfield, they planted bombs under runways with days-long time delays and dug plenty of other holes that looked like they might contain bombs. In the foothills, he supervised much of the layout of their defensive lines himself and kept up his visits to airfields, regional headquarters and operational units. He kept up, too, the pressure on the high priests at least to consider using the spacecraft for a decapitation strike. He was busy, he realized one day, as he lay down to sleep in an old castle that had become operational HQ for this section of the front. The sky had bloomed with light on the tree-lined horizon and the air shaken with the sound of a bombardment just after dusk. Busy and, he had to admit as he put the last reports on the floor under the camp bed and put the light out and was almost instantly asleep, happy. 2 weeks, 3 weeks from his arrival, the little news that came in from outside seemed to indicate there was an awful lot of nothing going on. He suspected there was a lot of intense politicking taking place. Beishai's name was mentioned. He was still on the Mersey station, in touch with the various parties. No word of the culture, or from it. He wondered if they ever just forgot things. Maybe they'd forget about him, leave him here, struggling forever in the priests and the Empire's insane war. The defences grew. The hegemonarchy's soldiers dug and built, but were mostly not under fire. And the Imperial Army gradually lapped against the foothills and paused. He had the Air Force harry the supply lines and the frontline units and pound the nearest airfields. There are far too many troops stationed here around the city. The best troops should be at the front. The attack will come soon. And if we're to counterattack successfully, and it could be very successfully if they're tempted to go for a knockout, they've little left in reserve, then we need those elite squads where they can do some good. There is the problem of civil unrest, Napueria said. He looked old and tired. Keep a few units here, and keep them in the streets, so people don't forget they're here. But damn it, Napueria, most of these guys spend all their time in barracks. They're needed at the front. I have just the place for them. Look. Actually, he wanted to tempt the Imperial Army to go for the knockout, and the city was to be the bait. He sent the crack troops into the mountain passes. The priests looked at how much territory they'd now lost, and tentatively gave the go-ahead for preparing for decapitation. The hegemonarchy victorious would be readied for its final flight, though not used unless the situation appeared genuinely desperate. He promised he would try to win the war conventionally first. The attack came 40 days after he had arrived on Mersey. The Imperial Army crashed into the foothill forests. The priests began to panic. He had the Air Force attack the supply lines the majority of the time, not the front. The defensive lines gradually gave way. Units retreated. Bridges were blown. Gradually, as the foothills led into the mountains, the Imperial Army was concentrated, funneled into the valleys. The trick with the dam didn't work this time. The charges placed under it just didn't go off. He had to move fast to shift 2 elite units to cover the pass above that valley. But if we leave the city, the priests looked stunned. Their eyes looked as empty as the painted blue circle on their foreheads. The Imperial Army was slowly moving up the valleys, forcing their soldiers back. He kept telling them things would be all right, but things just got worse and worse. There was nothing else for them to do. It all seemed too hopeless and too late to take things back into their own hands. Last night, with the wind blowing down from the mountains to the city, the sound of distant artillery had been audible. "They'll try to take Balzite City if they think they can," he said. "It's a symbol. Well, fine. But it doesn't actually have much military importance. They'll grab at it. We let just so many through. Then we close the passes here," he said, tapping the map. The priests shook their heads. "Gents, we are not in disarray. We are falling back. But they are in much worse shape than we are, taking far heavier casualties. Each meter is costing them blood. And all the time, their supply lines get longer. We must take them to the point where they start to think about pulling back, then present them with the possibility, the seeming possibility, of a knockout blow. But it won't knock us out. It knocks them out." He looked round them. "Believe me, it'll work. You may have to leave the citadel for a while, but when you return, I guarantee it will be in triumph." They did not look convinced, but possibly because they were just too stunned to fight, they let him have his way. It took a few days while the Imperial army struggled up the valleys and the Hegemoniki's forces resisted, retreated, resisted, retreated, but eventually, watching for signs that the Imperial soldiers were tiring and the tanks and trucks were not always moving when they might have wanted to, starved of fuel, he decided that were he on the other side, he'd be thinking about halting the advance. That night, in the pass which led down to the city, most of the Hegemoniki troops left their positions. In the morning, the battle resumed, and the Hegemoniki's men suddenly retreated shortly before they would have been overrun. A puzzled, excited, but still exhausted and worried general in the Imperial High Command watched through field glasses as a distant convoy of trucks crawled away down the pass towards the city, occasionally strafed by Imperial aircraft. Reconnaissance suggested the infidel priests were making preparations to leave their citadel. Spies indicated that their spacecraft was being readied for some special mission. The general radioed the court high command. The order to advance on the city was given the following day. He watched the terminally worried-looking priests leave from the train station under the citadel. In the end, he had to dissuade them from ordering the decapitation attack. "Let me try this first," he told them. They could not understand each other. The priests looked at the territory they had lost and the fraction they had left and thought it was all over for them. He looked at his relatively unscathed divisions, his fresh units, his crack squads, all positioned just where they should be, knives laid against and inside the body of an overextended, worn-out enemy, just ready to cut, and thought it was all over for the Empire. The train pulled out, and, unable to resist, he waved cheerily. The high priests would be better out of the way, in one of their great monasteries in the next mountain range. He ran back upstairs to the map room to see how things were going. He waited until a couple of divisions had made it through the pass, then had the units that had held it, and mostly retreated into the forests around the pass, not gone down the pass at all, take it again. The city and the citadel were bombed, though not well. The Hegemoniki's fighters shot most of the bombers down. The counterattack finally began. He started with the elite troops, then brought in the rest. The Air Force still concentrated on the supply lines for the first couple of days, then switched to the front line. The Imperial Army wavered, line crinkling. It seemed to hesitate like some wash of water, almost but not quite capable of overspilling the damming line of mountains, save in one place. And that trickle was drying, still pushing for the city, leaving the pass, fighting through the forests and fields for the shining goal they still hoped might win the war. Then the line fell back, the soldiers too exhausted, their supplies of ammunition and fuel too sporadic. The passes stayed with the Hegemoniki, and slowly they pushed down from them again, so that it must have seemed to the Imperial soldiers that they were forever shooting uphill, and that while advancing had been a heavy, dangerous slog, retreating was only too easy. The retreat became a rout in valley after valley. He insisted on keeping the counterattack going. The priests cabled that more forces ought to be deployed to stop the advance of the two Imperial divisions on the capital. He ignored them. There was barely enough left of the two tattered divisions to make one whole one, and they were being gradually eroded further all the time. It was possible they might make it to the city, but after that they would have nowhere to go. He thought it might be satisfying to accept their eventual surrender personally. The rains came on the far side of the mountains, and as the bedraggled imperial forces made their way through the dripping forests, their air force was all too often grounded by bad weather, while the hegemonarchy's planes bombed and strafed them with impunity. People fled to the city. Artillery duels thundered nearby. The remnants of the two divisions that had broken through the mountains fought desperately on towards their goal. On the distant plains on the far side of the mountains, the rest of the Imperial army was retreating as fast as it could. The divisions, trapped in Shinastri province, unable to retreat through the quagmire behind them, surrendered en masse. The Imperial court signalled its desire for peace the day what was left of its two divisions entered Balzite City. They had 12 tanks and 1,000 men, but they left their artillery in the fields, bereft of ammunition. The few thousand people left in the city sought refuge in the wide parade grounds of the citadel. He watched them stream in through the gates in the high walls, far in the distance. He'd been going to quit the citadel that day. The priests had been screaming at him to do so for days, and most of the general staff had already left. But now he held a transcript of the message they'd just received from the Imperial court. Two hegemonarchy divisions were, anyway, on their way out of the mountains, coming to the aid of the city. He radioed the priests. They decided to accept a truce. Fighting would stop immediately if the Imperial army withdrew to the positions it had held before the war. There were a few more radio exchanges. He left the priests and the Imperial court to sort it all out. He took off his uniform, and for the first time since he'd arrived, dressed as a civilian. He went to a high tower with some field glasses and watched the tiny specks that were enemy tanks as they rolled down a street far away. The citadel gates were closed. A truce was declared at midday. The weary Imperial soldiers outside the citadel gates billeted themselves in the bars and hotels nearby. He stood in the long gallery and faced into the light. The tall white curtains billowed softly around him, quiet in the warm breeze. His long black hair was lifted only slightly by the gentle wind. His hands were clasped behind his back. He looked pensive. The silent, lightly clouded skies over the mountains, beyond the fortress and the city, threw a blank, pervasive light across his face, and standing there like that, in plain, dark clothes, he looked insubstantial, like some statue or a dead man propped against the battlements to fool the foe.
Zukalwe?
He turned. His eyes widened in surprise.
Scaffin Antiscor? This is an unexpected honour. Smile letting you out alone these days, or is she about too?
He looked the length of the citadel's long gallery.
Good day, Sharadanin, the drone said, floating towards him. Ms. Smar is on her way in a module.
And how is Dizzy?
He sat down on a small bench set against the wall, which faced the long line of white-curtained windows.
What's the news?
I believe it is mostly good,
Scaffin Antiscor said, floating level with his face.
Mr. Beishai is on his way to the Imbrin habitats, where a summit conference between the cluster's two main tendencies is to be held. It would appear the danger of war is lessening.
Well, isn't this all very wonderful, he said,
sitting back with his hands behind his neck.
Peace here, peace out there.
He squinted at the drone, his head to one side.
And yet, drone, somehow you do not seem to be overflowing with joy and happiness. You seem, dare I say it, positively somber. What's the matter? Batteries low?
The machine was silent for a second or two. Then it said,
I believe Ms. Smar's module is about to land. Shall we go to the roof?
He looked puzzled for a moment, then nodded, stood smartly and clapped his hands once, indicating the way forward.
Certainly, let's go.
They went to his apartments. He thought Smar seemed rather subdued, too. He'd imagined she'd be bubbling over with excitement because the cluster looked like it wasn't going to go to war after all.
What's the problem, Dizzy?
He asked, pouring her a drink. She was pacing up and down in front of the room's shuttered windows. She took the drink from him, but didn't seem interested in it. She turned to face him, her long, oval face looking... He wasn't sure.
but there was a cold feeling somewhere in his guts.
"You have to leave, Sharadanin," she told him.
"Leave? When?"
"Now. Tonight. Tomorrow morning at the latest."
He looked confused, then laughed. "Okay. I confess the Catamites were starting to look attractive, but..."
"No," Smar said. "I'm serious, Sharadanin. You have to go." He shook his head.
"I can't. There's no guarantee the truce will hold. They might need me."
"The truce isn't going to hold," Smar told him, looking away. "Not on one side, anyway."
She put her glass down on a shelf. "Eh?" he said.
He glanced at the drone, which was looking non-committal.
"Dizzyed? What are you talking about?"
"Zakalwe," she said, eyes blinking rapidly. She tried to look at him. "A deal's been done. You have to leave."
He stared at her.
"What's the deal, Dizzy?" he said softly.
"There was some fairly low-level help being given to the Empire by the Humanist faction," she told him,
walking towards one wall, then returning, talking not to him, but to the tile and carpet floor.
"They had face invested in what's been happening here. The whole delicate structure of the deal did rather depend on the Empire triumphing here."
She stopped, glanced at the drone, looking away again.
"Which is what everybody agreed was going to happen, up until a few days ago."
"So?"
he said slowly, putting aside his own drink, sitting down in a great chair that looked like a throne. "I messed things up by turning the game against the Empire, did I?"
"Yes," Smar said, swallowing. "Yes, you did. I'm sorry. And I know it's crazy, but that's the way things are here. The way the people are here. The Humanists are divided at the moment, and there are factions within them that would use any excuse to argue for getting out of the deal, however insignificant that excuse might be. They might just be able to pull the whole thing down. We can't take that risk. The Empire has to win."
He sat, looking at a small table in front of him. He sighed.
"I see. And all I have to do is leave."
"Yes, come with us."
"What happens after that?"
"The High Priests will be kidnapped by an Imperial Commando squad brought in by Humanist-controlled aircraft. The Citadel here will be taken over by the troops outside. There are raids planned on the field HQs. They should be pretty bloodless. If necessary, the Hegemonarchy planes, tanks, artillery pieces and trucks will be put out of action, should the armed forces ignore the call put out by the High Priesthood to surrender their arms. Once they've seen a few planes and tanks laser-blasted from space, it's expected the fight will go out of the army."
Smar stopped pacing, came to stand in front of him on the far side of the little table.
"It all happens at dawn tomorrow. It should be fairly bloodless, really, Zakalwe. You might as well leave now. It would be best."
He heard her exhale.
"You've done brilliantly, Sharadanin. It's worked. You did it. Brought Beishai out. Got him motivated or whatever. We're grateful. We're very grateful. And it's not easy."
He raised one hand to stop her. He heard her sigh. He looked up from the small table, up to her face.
"I can't leave right away. There are a few things I have to do. I'd rather you left now and then came back. Pick me up tomorrow at dawn."
He shook his head.
"I won't desert them until then."
Smar opened her mouth, then closed it, glanced at the drone.
"All right, we'll be back tomorrow."
"Zakalwe, it's all right, Dizziet,"
he interrupted calmly and slowly stood up. He looked into her eyes. She had to look away.
"It'll be as you say. Goodbye."
He didn't hold out his hand. Smar walked to the door. The drone followed her. The woman looked back. He nodded once. She hesitated, seemed to think the better of saying anything, and went out. The drone stopped there too.
"Zakalwe," it said. "I just want to add..."
"Out!"
he screamed, and in one movement turned, swooped, caught the small table between the legs, and threw it with all his might at the floating machine. The table bounced off an invisible field and clattered to the floor. The drone swept out and the door closed. He stood, staring at it for some time.
Numeral 2. He was younger then. The memories were still fresh. He discussed them with the frozen, seemingly sleeping people sometimes, on his wanderings through the cold, dark ship, and wondered, in its silence, if he really was mad. The experience of being frozen and of then being woken up had done nothing to dull his memories. They remained keen and bright. He had rather hoped that the claims they made for freezing were over-optimistic, and the brain did indeed lose at least some of its information. He'd secretly desired that attrition, but been disappointed. The process of warning and revival was actually rather less traumatic and confusing than coming round after being knocked unconscious, something that had happened to him a few times in his life. Revival was smoother, took longer, and was really quite pleasant. In truth, quite like waking up after a good night's sleep. They left him alone for a couple of hours after they'd run the medical checks and pronounced him fit and well. He sat wrapped in a big thick towel on the bed and, like somebody probing a diseased tooth with tongue or finger, unable to stop checking that it really does hurt every now and again, he called up his memories, going through the roll call of those old and recent adversaries he'd hoped he might have lost somewhere in the darkness and the cold of space. All his past was indeed present, and everything that had been wrong present too, and correct. The ship was called the Absent Friends. Its journey would take it over a century. It was a mercy voyage, in a way. Its services donated by its alien owners to help assuage the aftereffects of a terrible war. He had not really deserved his place, and had used false papers and a false name to secure his escape. He'd volunteered to be woken up near the middle of the journey to provide part of the human crew because he thought it would be a shame to travel in space and never really know it, never appreciate it, never look out into that void. Those who did not choose to do crew duty would be drugged on planet, taken into space unconscious, frozen out there, and then wake up on another planet. This seemed undignified to him. To be treated so was to become cargo. The two other people on duty when he was woken were Kai and Erens. Erens had been supposed to return to the ranks of the frozen people 5 years earlier, after a few months of duty on the ship, but had decided to stay awake until they arrived at their destination. Kai had been revived 3 years later and should also have gone back to sleep, to be replaced after a few months by the next person on the crew rota. But by then, Erens and Kai had started to argue, and neither wanted to be the first to return to the stasis of the freeze. There had been stalemate for 2.5 years while the great slow ship moved, quiet and cold, past the distant pinprick lights that were the stars. Finally, they'd woken him up at last, because he was next on the rota, and they wanted somebody else to talk to. As a rule, however, he just sat in the crew section and listened to the two of them argue.
"There's still 50 years to go," Kai reminded Erens.
Erens waved a bottle.
"I can wait, it isn't forever."
Kai nodded at the bottle. "You'll kill yourself with that stuff, and all the other junk you take. You'll never make it. You'll never see real sunlight again, or taste rain. You won't last 1 year, let alone 50. You should go back to sleep."
"It isn't sleep."
"You should go back to it, whatever you want to call it. You should let yourself be frozen again,
and it isn't literally frozen. Freezing, either."
Erens looked annoyed and puzzled at the same time. The man they'd woken up wondered how many hundreds of times the two had been through this argument. "You should go back into your little cold cubicle like you were supposed to 5 years ago and get them to treat you for your addictions when they revive you," Kai said.
"The ship already treats me," Erens told Kai, with a kind of slow, drunken dignity. "I am in a state of grace with my enthusiasms. Sublimely tensioned grace."
So saying, Erens tipped the bottle back and drained it. "You'll kill yourself."
"It's my life."
"You might kill us all. Everybody in the whole ship, sleepers too."
"The ship looks after itself," Erens sighed.
looking round the crew lounge. It was the only dirty place on the ship. Everywhere else, the ship's robots tidied, but Erens had worked out how to delete the crew lounge from the craft's memory, and so the place could look good and scruffy. Erens stretched, kicking a couple of small recyclable cups off the table.
"Huh," Kai said.
"What have you damaged it with all your messing around?"
"I have not been messing around with it," Erens said with a small sneer. "I have altered a few of the more basic housekeeping programs. It doesn't talk to us anymore, and it lets us keep this place looking lived in. That's about it. Nothing that's going to make the ship wander into a star or start thinking it's human, and what are these intestinal parasites doing in there? But you wouldn't understand. No technical background. Livo here, he might understand, eh?"
Erens stretched out further, sliding down the grubby seat, boots scraping on the filthy surface of the table.
"You understand, don't you, Darak?"
"I don't know," he admitted. He was used to answering to Darak or Mr. Livu or just Livu by now. "I suppose if you know what you're doing, there's no real harm." Erens looked pleased. "On the other hand, a lot of disasters have been caused by people who thought they knew what they were doing."
"Amen," Kai said, looking triumphant, and leant aggressively towards Erens. "See?" "As our friend said," Erens pointed out, reaching for another bottle. "He doesn't know."
"You should go back with the sleepers," Kai said.
"They're not sleeping."
"You're not supposed to be up right now. There's only supposed to be two people up at any point."
"You go back then."
"It isn't my turn. You were up first." He left them to argue. Sometimes, he would put a spacesuit on and go through the airlock into the storage sections, which were in vacuum. The storage sections made up most of the ship, over 99% of it. There was a tiny drive unit at one end of the craft, an even tinier living unit at the other, and, in between, the bulging bulk of the ship, packed with the undead. He walked the cold, dark corridors, looking from side to side at the sleeper units. They looked like drawers in a filing cabinet. Each was the head end of something very like a coffin. A little red light glowed faintly on each one, so that standing in one of the gently spiralling corridors, with his own suit light switched off, those small and steady sparks curved away in a ruby lattice folded over the darkness, like some infinite corridor of red giant suns set up by some obsessively tidy-minded god. Spiralling gradually upwards, moving away from the living unit at what he always thought of as the head of the ship, he walked up through its quiet, dark body. Usually, he took the outermost corridor, just to appreciate the scale of the vessel. As he ascended, the pull of the ship's fake gravity gradually decreased. Eventually, walking became a series of skidding leaps, in which it was always easier to hit the ceiling than make any forward progress. There were handles on the coffin drawers. He used them once walking became too inefficient, pulling himself along towards the waist of the ship, which, as he approached it, turned one wall of coffin drawers to a floor and the other to a ceiling in places. Standing under a radial corridor, he leapt up, floated towards what was now the ceiling, with the radial corridor a chimney up through it. He caught a coffin drawer handle and used a succession of them as rungs, climbing into the centre of the ship. Running through the centre of the absent friends, there was an elevator shaft that extended from living unit to drive unit. In the very centre of the whole ship, he would summon the elevator, if it wasn't already waiting there from last time. When it came, he would enter it, floating inside the squat yellow-lit cylinder. He would take out a pen, or a small torch, and place it in the centre of the elevator car, and just float there, watching the pen or torch, waiting to see if he had stationed it so exactly in the centre of the whole slowly spinning mass of the ship that it would stay where he'd left it. He got very good at doing this eventually, and could spend hours sitting there, with the suit lights and the elevator lights on sometimes, if it was a pen, or off if it was a torch, watching the little object, waiting for his own dexterity to prove greater than his patience, waiting for, in other words, he could admit to himself, one part of his obsession to win over the other. If the pen or torch moved and eventually connected with the walls or floor or ceiling of the elevator car, or drifted through the open door, then he had to float, climb, down, and then pull and walk back the way he had come, If it stayed still in the centre of the car, he was allowed to take the elevator back to the living unit.
"Come on, Darak," Aaron said, lighting up a pipe. "What brought you along on this one-way ride, eh?"
"I don't want to talk about it." He turned up the ventilation to get rid of Aaron's drug fumes. They were in the viewing carousel, the one place in the ship where you could get a direct view of the stars. He came up here every now and again, opened the shutters, and watched the stars spin slowly overhead. Sometimes he tried to read poetry. Aaron's still visited the carousel alone as well, but Kai no longer did. Aaron's reckoned Kai got homesick, seeing the silent nothingness out there and the lonely specks that were other suns.
"Why not?" Aaron said.
He shook his head and sat back in the couch, looking out into the darkness.
"It isn't any of your business." "I'll tell you why I came along if you tell me why you did."
Aaron's grinned, making the words sound childish, conspiratorial.
"Get lost, Aaron's." "Mine is an interesting story. You'd be fascinated."
"I'm sure," he sighed.
"But I won't tell you unless you tell me first. You're missing a lot."
"Mm-hmm." "Well, I'll just have to live with that," he said. He turned down the lighting in the carousel until the brightest thing in it was Aaron's face, glowing red with reflected light on each drawer of the pipe. He shook his head when Aaron's offered him the drug.
"You need to loosen up, my friend," Aaron's told him, slumping back in the other seat. "Get high. Share your problems."
"What problems?" He saw Aaron's head shake in the darkness.
"Nobody on this ship hasn't got problems, friend. Nobody out here not running away from something."
"Ah, ship psychiatrists now, are we?"
"Hey, come on. Nobody's going back, are they? Nobody on here's ever going back home. Half the people we know are probably dead already, and the ones that aren't will be by the time we get where we're going. So if we can't ever see the people we used to know again, and probably never see home again, it has to be something pretty damn important and pretty damn bad, pretty damn evil to make a body up and leave like that. We all got to be running from something, whether it's something we did or something we had done to us."
"Maybe some people just like travelling."
"That's crap. Nobody likes travelling that much."
He shrugged. "Whatever."
"Oh, Darak, come on. Argue, damn it."
"I don't believe in argument," he said, looking out into the darkness, and saw a towering ship, a capital ship, ringed with its layers and levels of armament and armour, dark against the dusk light, but not dead.
"You don't?"
Aaron said, genuinely surprised.
"Shit! And I thought I was the cynical one."
"It's not cynicism," he said flatly. "I just think people overvalue argument, because they like to hear themselves talk."
"Oh, well, thank you."
"It's comforting, I suppose." He watched the stars wheel like absurdly slow shells seen at night, rising, peaking, falling, and reminded himself that the stars too would explode, perhaps one day. "Most people are not prepared to have their minds changed," he said. "And I think they know in their hearts that other people are just the same. And one of the reasons people become angry when they argue is that they realize just that as they trot out their excuses."
"Excuses, eh? Well, if this ain't cynicism, what is?"
Aaron snorted. "Yes, excuses," he said, with what Aaron's thought might just have been a trace of bitterness. "I strongly suspect the things people believe in are usually just what they instinctively feel is right. The excuses, the justifications, the things you're supposed to argue about come later. They're the least important part of the belief. That's why you can destroy them, win an argument, prove the other person wrong, and still they believe what they did in the first place." He looked at Aaron's. "You've attacked the wrong thing."
"So what do you suggest one does, Professor, if one is not to indulge in this futile arguing stuff?"
"Agree to disagree," he said. "Or fight."
"Fight?"
He shrugged. "What else is left?"
"Negotiate?"
"Negotiation is a way to come to a conclusion. It's the type of conclusion that I'm talking about."
"Which basically is disagree or fight."
"If it comes to it." Erends was silent for a while, drawing on the pipe until its red glow faded, then saying,
"You have a military background at all, yeah?"
He sat and watched the stars. Eventually, he turned his head and looked at Erends. "I think the war gave us all a military background. Don't you?"
Erends said.
They both studied the slowly moving starfield. Twice, in the depths of the sleeping ship, he almost killed somebody. One of those times, it was somebody else. He stopped on the long, spiralling outer corridor, about halfway to the waist of the ship, where he felt very light on his feet, and his face was a little flushed with effects of normal blood pressure working against the reduced pull. He hadn't intended to look at any of the stored people. The truth was, he never really thought about them in any but the most abstract way. But suddenly, he wanted to see something more of a sleeper than just a little red light. He stopped at one of the coffin drawers. He had been shown how to work them after he'd volunteered to act as crew and had another, rather perfunctory run through the procedures shortly after being revived. He turned the suit lights on, flipped out the drawer's control pad, and carefully, using one bulky gloved finger, keyed in the code that Erends said turned off the ship's monitoring system. A little blue light came on. The red light stayed steady. If it flashed, the ship knew there was something wrong. He unlocked the cabinet, drew the whole device, sliding out. He looked at the woman's name, printed on a plastic strip stuck to the head unit. No one he knew anyway, he thought. He opened the inner cover. He looked in at the woman's calm, deathly pale face. His lights reflected on the crinkled, transparent plastic wrapping covering her like something you'd buy in a shop. Tubes in her nose and mouth leading away beneath her. A small screen flashed on above her tied-up hair on the head unit. He looked. She seemed in good shape, for somebody so nearly completely dead. Her hands were crossed across the chest of the paper tunic she wore. He looked at her fingernails, like Erends had said. Quite long, but he'd seen people grow them longer. He looked at the control pad again, entered another code. Lights flashed all over the control surface. The red light did not start flashing, but almost everything else did. He opened a little red and green door set in the top of the head unit. Out of it, he took a small sphere of what looked like fine green wires, containing an ice blue cube. A compartment alongside gave access to a covered switch. He pushed the cover back, put his finger down to the switch. He held the woman's recorded brain patterns, backed up onto the little blue cube. Easily crushable. His other hand, finger resting on the small switch, could turn off her life. He wondered if he would do it, and seemed to wait for a while, as if expecting some part of his own mind to assume control from him. A couple of times it seemed to him that he felt the start of the impulse to throw the switch and could have started to do so just an instant later, but each time suppressed the urge. He left his finger there, looked at the small cube inside its protective cage. He thought how remarkable and at the same time how oddly sad it was that all of a human mind could be contained in something so small. Then he reflected that a human brain was not so very much bigger than the little blue cube, and used resources and techniques far more ancient, and so was no less impressive, and still as sad. He closed the woman up again in her chill sleep, and continued on his slow-motion walk to the centre of the ship. "I don't know any stories."
"Everybody knows stories," Kai told him.
"I don't. Not proper stories."
"What's a proper story?" Kai sneered.
They sat in the crew lounge, surrounded by their debris. He shrugged. "An interesting one. One people want to listen to."
"People want to listen to different things. What one person would call a proper story might not please somebody else."
"Well, I can only go by what I think would be a proper story, and I don't have any. Not stories that I want to tell, anyway." He grinned coldly at Kai.
"Ah, that's different."
Kai nodded. "Indeed it is."
"Well, tell me what you believe in, then," Kai said, leaning towards him.
"Why should I?"
"Why shouldn't you? Tell me because I asked."
"No."
Don't be so standoffish. We're the only three people for billions of kilometres, and the ship's a bore. Who else is there to talk to?
Nothing.
Exactly. Nothing and nobody.
Kai looked pleased. No, I meant that's what I believe in. Nothing.
At all?
He nodded. Kai sat back, thoughtful, nodding.
They must have hurt you bad.
Who?
Whoever robbed you of whatever it was you used to believe in.
He shook his head slowly. Nobody ever robbed me of anything, he said.
Kai was silent for a while, so he sighed and said,
So, Kai, what do you believe in?
Kai looked at the blank screen that covered most of one wall of the lounge.
Something other than nothing.
Anything with a name is other than nothing, he said.
I believe in what's around us, Kai said,
arms crossed, sitting back in the seat.
I believe in what you can see from the carousel, what we'd see if that screen was on. Although, what you'd see wouldn't be the only sort of what I believe in that I believe in.
In a word, Kai, he said.
Emptiness, Kai said, with a flickering, jittery smile. I believe in emptiness.
He laughed. That's pretty close to nothing.
Not really, Kai said.
Looks it to most of us.
Let me tell you a sort of story.
Must you?
No more than you must listen.
Yeah, okay then. Anything to pass the time.
The story is this. It's a true story, by the way, not that that matters. There is a place where the existence or non-existence of souls is taken very seriously indeed. Many people, whole seminaries, colleges, universities, cities, and even states devote almost all their time to the contemplation and disputation of this matter and related topics. About 1,000 years ago, a wise philosopher king, who was considered the wisest man in the world, announced that people spent too much time discussing these things and could, if the matter was settled, apply their energies to more practical pursuits which would benefit everybody. So he would end the argument once and for all. He summoned the wisest men and women from every part of the world and of every known persuasion to discuss the matter. It took many years to assemble every single person who wished to take part, and the resulting debates, papers, tracts, books, intrigues, and even fights and murders took even longer. The philosopher king took himself off to the mountains to spend these years alone, emptying his mind of everything so that he would be able, he hoped, to come back once the process of argument was ended and pronounce the final decision. After many years, they sent for the king, and when he felt ready, he listened to everyone who thought they had something to say on the existence of souls. When they had all said their piece, the king went away to think. After a year, the king announced he had come to his decision. He said that the answer was not quite so simple as everybody had thought, and he would publish a book in several volumes to explain the answer. The king set up two publishing houses, and each published a great and mighty volume. One repeated the sentences, souls do exist, souls do not exist, time after time, part after part, page after page, section after section, chapter after chapter, book after book. The other repeated the words, souls do not exist, souls do exist, in the same fashion. In the language of the kingdom, I might add, each sentence had the same number of words, even the same number of letters. These were the only words to be found beyond the title page in all the thousands of pages in each volume. The king had made sure that the books began and finished printing at the same time, and were published at the same time, and that exactly the same number were published. Neither of the publishing houses had any perceivable superiority or seniority over the other. People searched the volumes for clues. They looked for a single repetition buried deep in the volumes, where a sentence or even a letter had been missed out or altered. But they found none. They turned to the king himself, but he had taken a vow of silence and bound up his writing hand. He would still nod or shake his head in reply to questions concerning the governing of his kingdom, but on the subject of the two volumes and the existence or otherwise of souls, the king would give no sign. Furious disputes arose. Many books were written. New cults began. Then, a half year after the two volumes had been published, two more appeared. And this time, the house that had published the volume beginning Souls Do Not Exist published the volume which began Souls Do Exist. The other publisher followed suit,
so that theirs now began, souls do not exist. This became the pattern. The king lived to be very old and saw several dozen volumes published. When he was on his deathbed, the court philosopher placed copies of the book on either side of him, hoping the king's head would fall to one side or the other at the moment of death, so indicating by the first sentence of the appropriate volume which conclusion he had really come to. But he died with his head straight on the pillow and with his eyes, under the eyelids, looking straight ahead. "That was 1,000 years ago," Kai said. "The books are published still. They have become an entire industry, an entire philosophy, a source of unending argument. And is there an ending to this story?" he asked, holding up one hand. "No," Kai smiled smugly. "There is not, but that is just the point." He shook his head, got up and left the crew lounge. "But just because something does not have an ending," Kai shouted, "doesn't mean it doesn't have a..." The man closed the elevator door outside in the corridor. Kai rocked forward in the seat and watched the lift level indicator ascend to the middle of the ship. "Conclusion," Kai said quietly. He'd been revived nearly half a year when he almost killed himself. He was in the elevator car, watching a torch he had left in the centre of the car as it slowly spun. He'd left the torch switched on and put out all the other lights. He watched the tiny spot of light move slowly around the circular wall of the car, slow as any clock hand. He remembered the searchlights of the Stabberind and wondered how far they were away from it now. So far that even the sun itself must be weaker than a searchlight seen from space. He did not know why that made him think of just taking off the helmet, but found himself starting to do it nevertheless. He stopped. It was quite a complicated procedure to open the suit while in vacuum. He knew each of the steps, but it would take some time. He looked at the white spot of light which the torch was shining on the wall of the lift, not far from his head. The white spot was gradually coming closer as the torch spun. He would start to ready the suit to take the helmet off. If the torch beam hit his eye, no, his face, any part of his head, before that, then he would stop and go back as though nothing had happened. Otherwise, if the spot of light did not strike his face in time, he would take the helmet off and die. He allowed himself the luxury of letting the memories wash over him, while his hands slowly began the sequence that would end, unless interrupted, with the helmet being blasted off his shoulders by the air pressure. Stabberind, the great metal ship stuck in stone, and a stone ship, a building, stuck in water. And the two sisters, D'Arcance, Livueta, and of course he'd realized at the time that he was taking their names, or something like their names, in making the one he masqueraded under now. And Zakalwe, and Alethiomel. Alethiomel the Terrible. Alethiomel the Chairmaker. The suit beeped at him, trying to warn him he was doing something very dangerous. The spot of light was a few centimetres from his head. Zakalwe. He tried to ask himself what the name meant to him. What did it mean to anybody? Ask them all back home, what does this name mean to you? War, perhaps, in the immediate aftermath. A great family, if your memory was long enough. A kind of tragedy, if you knew the story. He saw the chair again, small and white. He closed his eyes, tasting bitterness in his throat. He opened his eyes. 3 final clips to go, then 1 quick twist. He looked at the spot of light. It was invisible. So close to the helmet, so close to his head. The torch in the centre of the elevator car was facing almost straight at him, its lens bright. He undid one of the 3 final helmet clips. There was a tiny hiss, barely noticeable. Dead, he thought, seeing the girl's pale face. He undid another clip. The hiss grew no louder. There was a sense of brightness at the side of the helmet, where the light would be shining. Metal ship, stone ship, and the unconventional chair. He felt tears come to his eyes, and one hand, the one not undoing the 3rd helmet clip, went to his chest, where, under the many synthetic layers of the suit, beneath the fabric of the undersuit, there was a small puckered mark on the skin just over his heart. A scar that was 2 decades old, or 7 decades old, depending how you measured time. The torch swung, and just as the final clip came undone and the spot of light started to leave the inside edge of the suit to shine on his face, the torch flickered and went out. He stared. It was almost totally dark. There was the hint of light from outside the car, the faintest of red glows produced by all the near-dead people and the quietly watching equipment. Out. The torch had gone out. Charge exhausted or just a fault, it didn't matter. It had gone out. It hadn't shone on his face. The suit beeped again, plaintive above the quiet hiss of escaping air. He looked down at the hand that lay over his chest. He looked back up at where the torch must be, unseen in the centre of the car, in the centre of the ship, in the middle of its journey. How do I die now? He thought. He did go back to his chill sleep after a year. Aaron's and Kai, their sexual predilections forever estranging them, despite the fact they seemed like a well-matched couple otherwise, were still arguing when he left. He ended up in another low-tech war, learning to fly, because he knew now that aircraft would always win against a battleship, and flying the frosty vortices of air above the vast white islands that were the colliding tabular icebergs.
Chapter 13. Where they lay, the discarded robes looked like the just-shed skin of some exotic reptile. He had been going to wear those, but then changed his mind. He would wear the clothes he had come here in. He stood in the bathroom, in its steams and smells, stropping the razor again, then putting it to his head, slowly and carefully, as though pulling a comb through his hair in slow motion. The razor scraped through the foam on his skin, catching a last few stubbly hairs. He swept the razor past the tops of his ears, then took up a towel, wiped the gleaming skin of his skull, inspecting the baby-smooth landscape he had revealed. The long dark hair lay scattered on the floor like plumage scattered during a fight. He looked out to the Citadel parade grounds, where a few weak fires glowed. Above the mountains, the sky was just starting to become light. From the window, he could see a few craggy levels of the Citadel's curbed wall and jutting towers. In that first outlining light, it looked, he thought, though trying hard not to feel maudlin, poignant, even noble, now that he knew it was doomed. He turned from the sight and went to put on his shoes. The air moved over his shaven skull, feeling very strange. He missed the feel and sweep of his hair on the nape of his neck. He sat on the bed, pulled on the shoes and clasped them, then looked at the telephone sitting on the bedside cabinet. He lifted the device. He recalled, he seemed to remember, contacting the spaceport last night, after Smar and Scaffin Amtiskor had gone. He had been feeling bad, dissociated and remote somehow, and he was not at all certain he really did remember calling the technicians there, but he thought he probably had. He'd told them to ready the ancient spacecraft for the decapitation strike sometime that morning. Or he hadn't. One of the two. Maybe he had been dreaming. He heard the Citadel operator asking him who he wanted. He asked for the spaceport. He talked to the technicians. The chief flight engineer sounded tense, excited. The craft was ready, fueled up, coordinates locked in. It could be launched within a few minutes as soon as he gave the word. He nodded to himself as he listened to the man. He heard the chief flight engineer pause. The question was unasked, but there. He watched the skies outside the window. They still looked dark from inside here.
Sir, the chief flight engineer said. Sir Zakalwi, what are your orders, sir?
He saw the little blue cube, the button. He heard the whisper of escaping air. There was a shudder just then. He thought it was his own body reacting involuntarily, but it was not. The shudder ran through the fabric of the Citadel, through the walls of the room, through the bed beneath him. Glass rattled in the room. The noise of the explosion rumbled through the air beyond the thick windows, low and unsettling.
Sir, the man said, are you still there?
They would probably intercept the spacecraft. The culture itself, the xenophobe probably, would use effectors on it. The decapitation strike was bound to fail.
What should we do, sir?
But there was always a possibility.
Hello?
Hello, sir. Another explosion shook the citadel. He looked at the handset he held.
Sir, do we go ahead?
He heard a man say, or remembered a man saying, from long ago and far away. And he had said yes, and taken on a terrible cargo of memories and all the names that might bury him.
Stand down, he said quietly. We won't need the strike now, he said.
He put the handset down and left the room quickly, taking the rear stairs away from the main entrance to his apartments, where he could already hear a commotion building. More explosions shook the citadel, dislodging dust around him as the curtain wall was breached and breached again. He wondered how it would be with the regional headquarters, how they would fall, and whether the raid to capture the high priests would be as bloodless as Smar had hoped. But he realized, even as he thought about it all, that he no longer really cared. He left the citadel via postern and entered the great square that was the parade ground. The small fires still burned outside the tents of the refugees. In the distance, great clouds of dust and smoke floated slowly into the grey dawn sky above the curtain wall. He could see a couple of gaps in the wall from here. The people in the tents were starting to wake up and come out. From the citadel walls at his back and above him, he could hear the crackle of gunfire. A heavier gun fired from the breached walls, and a huge explosion shook the ground, ripping a great hole in the cliff that was the citadel. An avalanche of stone thundered into the parade ground, burying a dozen tents. He wondered what sort of ammunition the tank was firing. Not a type they'd had until this morning, he suspected. He walked on through the tent city as the people appeared, blinking from their sleep. Scattered firing continued from the citadel. The vast cloud of dust rolled over the parade ground from the great tumbled breach in the towering walls. Another shot from near the curtain walls, another ground-quaking detonation that brought a whole side of the citadel down. The stones bursting from the wall as though with relief, falling and tumbling in their own rolling dust, released, returning to the earth. There was less firing from the citadel ramparts now, as the dust drifted and the sky slowly lightened, and the frightened people clutched at each other outside their tents. More firing came from the breached curtain walls and from inside the parade ground within the tent city. He walked on. Nobody stopped him. Few people really seemed to notice him. He saw a soldier fall from the curtain wall to his right, tumbling into the dust. He saw the people running this way and that. He saw the Imperial Army soldiers in the distance, riding on a tank. He walked through the clustered tents, avoiding people running, stepping over a couple of the smouldering fires. The huge breaches in the curtain wall and the citadel itself smoked in the increasing grey light, which was just starting to take on colour as the sky burned pink and blue. Sometimes, as the people milled and streamed around him, running past, clutching babies, dragging children, he thought he saw people he recognised, and several times was on the point of turning and talking to them, putting out his hand to stop the snowfall of faces rushing past him, shouting after them. Suddenly, aircraft screamed overhead, tearing through the air over the curtain wall, dropping long canisters into the tents, which erupted in flame and black, black smoke. He saw burning people, heard the screams, smelled the roasting flesh. He shook his head. Terrified people jostled him, bumped into him, once knocked him down so that he had to pick himself up, dust himself down, and suffer the knocks and the shouts and screams and curses. The aircraft came back, strafing, and he was the only one who stayed upright, walking while the rest fell to the ground. He watched the puffs and bursts of dust fountain in lines around him, saw the clothing of a few of the fallen people suddenly jerk and flap as a round hit home. It was getting lighter as he encountered the first troops. He dodged behind a tent and rolled as a trooper fired at him, then got back on his feet and ran round the rear of a tent, almost bumping into another soldier, who swung his carbine round too late. He kicked it away. The soldier drew a knife. He let him lunge and took the knife, throwing the soldier to the ground. He looked at the blade he held in his hand and shook his head. He threw the knife away, looked at the soldier, lying on the ground, staring fearfully up at him, then shrugged and walked away. Still, people rushing past, soldiers shouting. He saw one take aim at him and could not see anywhere to go for cover. He raised his hand to explain, to say there was really no need, but the man shot him anyway. Not a very good shot, considering the range, he thought, as he was kicked back and spun round by the force of the impact. Upper chest, near the shoulder. No lung damage, and possibly not even a chipped rib, he thought, as the shock and pain burst through him and he fell. He lay still in the dust, near the staring face of a dead city guardsman. As he'd spun round, he'd seen the culture module, a clear shape hovering uselessly over the remains of his apartments high in the ruined citadel. Somebody kicked him, turning him over and bursting a rib at the same time. He tried not to react to the stab of pain, but looked through cracked eyes. He waited for the coup de grace, but it did not come. The shadow figure above him, dark against light, passed on. He lay a while longer, then got up. It wasn't too difficult to walk at first, but then the planes came back again, and though he didn't get hit by a bullet, something splintered somewhere nearby as he passed by some tents that shook and rippled as the bullets hit them, and he wondered if the sharp, puncturing pain in his thigh was a bit of wood or stone, or even bone, from somebody in one of the tents. No, he muttered to himself as he limped away, heading for the biggest breach in the wall. No, not funny. Not bone. Not funny. An explosion blew him off his feet, into and through a tent. He got up, head buzzing. He looked round and up at the citadel, its summit starting to glow with the first direct sunlight of the day. He couldn't see the module anymore. He took a shattered wooden tent pole to use as a crutch. His leg was hurting. Dust wrapped him. Screams of engines and aircraft and human voices pierced him. The smells of burning and stone dust and exhaust fumes choked him. His wounds talked to him in the languages of pain and damage, and he had to listen to them, but paid them no further heed. He was shaken and pummeled, and tripped and stumbled and drained, and fell to his knees, and thought perhaps he was hit by more bullets, but was no longer sure. Eventually, near the breach, he fell and thought he might just lie here for a while. The light was better, and he felt tired. The dust drifted like pale shrouds. He looked up at the sky, pale blue, and thought how beautiful it was, even through all this dust, and listening to the tanks as they came crunching up through the slope of wrecked stones, reflected that, like tanks everywhere, they squeaked more than they roared. Gentlemen, he whispered to the rabid blue sky. I am reminded of something the worshipful Smar said to me once on the subject of heroism, which was something like, Sir Calway, in all the human societies we have ever reviewed in every age and every state, there has seldom if ever been a shortage of eager young males prepared to kill and die to preserve the security, comfort, and prejudices of their elders. And what you call heroism is just an expression of this simple fact. There is never a scarcity of idiots. He sighed. Well, no doubt she didn't say every age and every state, because the culture just loves there to be exceptions to everything, but that was the gist of it, I think. He rolled over, away from the achingly blue sky, to stare at the blurred dust. Eventually, reluctantly, he pushed himself over, and then half up, then to his knees, then clutched at the tentpole crutch and forced down onto it and got to his feet, ignoring all the pestering aches and pains, and staggered for the piled wreckage of the walls, and somehow dragged and hauled and scraped his way to the top, where the walls ran smooth and wide for a way, like roadways in the sky, and the bodies of a dozen or so soldiers lay blood pooling, the ramparts around them scarred with bullet holes and grey with dust. He staggered towards them, as though anxious to be one of their number. He scanned the skies for the module. It was some time before they spotted the Z sign he made from the bodies on the top of the walls, but in that language it was a complicated letter, and he kept getting mixed up. Numeral 1. No lights burned on the Stabarind. It sat squat against the grey leechings of the false dawn, its dim silhouette a piled cone which only hinted at the concentric loops and lines of its decks and guns. Some effect of the marsh mists between him and the ziggurat of the ship made it look as though its black shape was not attached to the land at all, but floated over it, poised like some threatening dark cloud. He watched with tired eyes, stood on tired feet. This close to the city and the ship, he could smell the sea, and nose, this close to the concrete of the bunker, a limey scent, acrid and bitter.
He tried to remember the garden and the smell of flowers, the way he sometimes did whenever the fighting started to seem just too futile and cruel to have any point whatsoever. But for once, he could not conjure up that faintly remembered, beguilingly poignant perfume, or recall anything good that had come out of that garden. Instead, he saw again those sun-tanned hands on his sister's pale hips, the ridiculous little chair they'd chosen for their fornication. And he remembered the last time he had seen the garden, the last time he'd been to the estate with the tank corps, and he'd seen the chaos and ruin Alethiamel had visited upon the place that had been the cradle for both of them, the great house gutted, the stone boat wrecked, the woods burned, and his last glimpse of the hateful little summer house where he'd found them, as he took his own retaliatory action against the tyranny of memory. The tank rocking beneath him, the already flare-lit clearing whiting out with bright flame, his ears ringing with a sound that was no sound, and the little house was still there. The shot had gone right through, exploded somewhere in the woods behind, and he'd wanted to weep and scream and tear it all down with his own hands. But then had remembered the man who had sat there and thought how he might treat something like this, and so had gathered the strength to laugh at it, and ordered the gunner to aim at the top step beneath the little house, and saw it all finally lift and burst into the air. The debris fell around the tank, sprinkling him with earth and wood and ripped bundles of thatch. The night beyond the bunker was warm and oppressive. The land's daytime heat, trapped and pressed to the ground by the weight of clouds above, sticking against the skin of the land like some sweat-soaked shirt. Perhaps the wind changed then, for he thought he detected the smell of the grass and the hay in the air, swept hundreds of kilometres from the great prairies inland by some wind since spent, the old fragrance going stale now. He closed his eyes and leant his forehead against the rough concrete of the bunker wall, beneath the slit he'd been looking through. His fingers splayed out lightly on the hard, grainy surface, and he felt the warm material press into his flesh. Sometimes, all he wanted was for it all to be over, and the way of it did not really seem to matter. Cessation was all, simple and demanding and seductive, and worth almost anything. That was when he had to think of D'Arcance, trapped on the ship, held captive by Alethiamel. He knew she didn't love their cousin anymore. That had been something brief and juvenile, something she'd used in her